Exactly, specialist of digitalization, and it's not about technical issues or so. I want to give you just because I've witnessed and in the context of film archives and so on, of course, there are a lot of conferences now about digitalization, and because the digitalization, of course, constrains the archives to think about everything they do from scrap, because everything changes, everything has to be decided again. The digitalization affects almost everything when you think about film archives. And so this is why I want to just for a few minutes talk about it, because digitalization is such a great word, but it means different things. It's about different problems. And I've witnessed in discussions that people sometimes are not aware of that and are not capable of separating the different problems from each other, and they mix everything together. And so I just want to give eight different aspects that I see that are subsumed under the term digitalization when it comes to film archiving. Or of course, in film production, I mean, now already in pre-production, in film production, many films are shot digitally, and in future, maybe every film will be shot digitally. But in post-production, of course, digitalization or the digital is important since many years, and this has, of course, also effects for the archive, because during the restoration of films, digital tools, of course, can help to fix problems that before were very difficult to fix or were not possible to fix at all. And this, of course, has led to another discussions about the ethics of restoration, because the question is always, what do you want? What original state do you want to restore? It's very difficult to talk about originals when it comes to films, because there are so many different kind of versions of every film. What is the original? And so, but somebody who restores a film must define some original. He must define the version that he wants to come as close as possible. And so the ethics, especially of the digital restoration, are important, because in a digital restoration, for example, you could clean the image completely. And the question then for the archivist is, do I want that? Or do I want that you can still, in the restored version, that you can see this film has a history, as they say, that this film has been played in many cinemas, and it's not a new film. I don't want to restore the film in a way that it looks new, because it's not a new film. And so I only want to restore it in a way that it's a pleasure again to see it, but not that it looks new. And so, and this is involved in digital restoration, especially. So post-production and then restoration is one part of the digitalization. Another question is the permanent storage. I've already talked about it when I talked about this Aaton company and this inventor, and the question of how should films be preserved for not future generation, but for the Marsmen who will come here in 10,000 years or so. And but permanent storage, I mean, you have to be aware of the fact that first of all, there are two different kinds of films who need permanent storage. One is the films that are already in the archive, and the other films are those who come new to the archive. And most of the films who will come to the archive in the future will come as a file, digital produced films. And most of the films who are already in the archive, they are on film material, 60 millimeter and so on, 35. And so if you decide to use digital tools for permanent storage, then you have to retro-digitize all the films which are still on film material, which is very, very expensive, and no film archive in the world has the money to do that, only very slowly. So this problem of permanent storage and digitization is one of the huge debates internationally between specialists. And there is one group that says, still today, for permanent storage, film material is the better solution. For example, Hollywood Film Academy, they have issued a catalog which is called The Digital Dilemma a couple of years ago. And so it's a study. And for the commercial American producers, and issued by the Academy. And it says, the conclusion is that today, the best way for long-term storage is to have the film on black and white film material, even color films on three different black and white strips, who then in the end can be put together to give the color image again. Because color, the problem is with color. Color film images, they deteriorate very quickly. So film material, black and white film material, this is their solution, not digital permanent storage, not as a file. Because digital files have to be, permuted or transformed or copied to another, to new generation of files, I think at least every 5 years, some say every 3 years or so. And so this is many people see a problem in that you have to copy films all the time, and then of course the software changes, the hardware changes, the environment changes, and I mean there are different solutions. For example, one can not only store the file but the whole environment for the file and so on, and all these platforms, you have to store not only your Word document but you also have to store Word 97 and Word 2000 and whatever and so on. This for the film, there are different solutions, but it's very unsure because nobody has long-term experience with digital files. Of course, it's very unsure of what will happen to these files because, of course, a digital file can deteriorate as well. And the other argument against long-term digital storage is that it's still more expensive because of the electricity and so on that you still need. And of course, storage, permanent storage space is still expensive when you talk about huge file structures. And so there are people who still think film material is the better solution. There are, on the other hand, of course, people who think that this is not true and we should also take digital files for permanent storage now, and there are arguments for both solutions. I think I just want you to make you aware of this problem. Of course, another point really inherent to the word digitalization is access, and I mean there is one thing that has to be said about it. I have witnessed that filmmakers who start to get interested in digital platforms for film heritage and so on, where old films in a digitized form can be seen in the internet and so on, platforms like this, they make one mistake. They think that if a film once is digitized, it's also stored. Many people make this mistake, and it's what I've talking about before. This is not true, because a digital file, of course, can deteriorate as well. But many people, even in the business, make this mistake. Yeah, that means if you digitize films in order to give access to them in your archive, people can come and watch the films, the files on a computer, or you put it in the internet and people can watch them at home, or whatever you do with them. If you digitize films for this purpose, it's one thing. The other thing is the film still has to be stored, permanently stored somewhere, be it digital or be it analog, but this is something else, nothing to do with it. Yeah, this is why you watch all those clips on YouTube and so on. They will be gone someday. This is nothing about permanent storage. There has been a debate about what you should call YouTube. Is it an archive, for example? Huge debate. Yeah? And if you take, as I've said before, the permanent storage as the key, the essential concept for the word archive, then of course YouTube is not an archive because it's not about permanent storage. Alaida Asman, the one with the concept of cultural memory, she said that YouTube, or the internet in total for her, is a stock market. I think it's an interesting image. It's about exchange and about values, evaluations, and so on. I think it's not bad, stock market, whatever. But it's not an archive. By the way, I mean, this is also interesting when you talk about access and archives, that, for example, a film archive like the British Film Archive, they have a channel on YouTube. There's a BFI channel, and the films they have the copyright for, or films without copyright, they put it on in a restored version on their YouTube channel, which is a nice idea. So, production and projection, and especially projection. As you know, all the cinemas are now going to be equipped with digital projectors, and you can get money from the European Union to fund your cinema for this switch to the digital projection. And of course, for film heritage institution, or for the film heritage in general, this could be a problem in the future, because most cinemas, almost every cinema that switches to digital projection, they throw away the 35mm or 60mm projector. On the other hand, as I've said, it will take a long, 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 long time to digitize all the films that were not produced digitally. That means that at a certain point you will have cinemas that can only project digital files, and huge archives of analog film material which cannot be projected in these cinemas. And so this means, for example, for many film heritage institutions have their own cinema, and for these kind of cinemas, for example, it means they will have to provide them with the new digital technique, but also with the old projectors. And another problem now in the beginning was that these digital files, they work with digital rights management. That means if you have the digital file of a film to project them in your cinema, it's defined what you can do with it or not. And those definitions, those standards, initially only allowed 24 images per second, which is a problem for early cinema and so on, where other frame rates were used. So with the initial solution for the digital projections, even digitized files of older films could not be projected in the right way. For example, I think this is somebody that they work on this, or they have already changed it. But these are problems. It means that with this digitalization, what goes along with it are several forms of standardization, of course. And by the way, it's exactly the same that happened when silent film switched into sound film. For example, the frame rate standard 24 frames per second. This is a sound film standard. And before, of course, films had many different frame rates, 16 frames per second or 20 or what, even because it was still filmed manually, of course the frame rate was not that exact as it has had to be in the sound era and so on. And these kind of standardizations also happen now, which means also the same as when it went from silent to sound, because in the silent era, as there was no recorded sound on the film, of course the producer and the filmmaker who made the film, they had no influence on the sound of the reception of the film later on, because the guy who showed the film, who exhibited the film, he could play music or not, he could talk about the film, the people in the auditorium, they could scream, they could laugh, they could do whatever they want. Nobody had influence on that. Only with recorded sound, people had to be quiet, and everything, the music, the dialogues, everything, the whole interpretation of the images, if you want, was already in the film. This is a very huge switch from silent to sound. And it's all about standardization. And with this standardization, of course, the power of the film theater owner who exhibited the film was his liberty, his was lost, and his power was lost. A lot of his power was lost. And I mean, now with the digital projection, it's just the same, because everything you can do with the film is encrypted, encoded in this digital rights management, and it can be when the film can be shown, you know, when the DRM says, okay, it can be shown between 2 and 4, you can show it at 6 if you want to, and so on. Yeah, it's much more strict than before, and less liberty for everybody who wants to show a film. You cannot, for example, if you have digital, this is the same with books someday, if you have the digital file with digital rights management, you cannot buy a book or a film and then lend it to your friend. It's impossible, because it only works under certain conditions on your reader, on your whatever, and so on and so on. So this is a standardization, and people who use, exhibit and use things lose liberty. So, yes, digital rights management, and this is, by the way, also a problem for the archive, because I think mostly they talk about digital source masters, which is the digital version of a negative, and digital cinema packages, which are the digital versions of the positives. And of course, also in the case of these digital files, as now I'm talking about films that are produced digitally and then given to an archive, then the archive gets the file. Of course, like in the analog era, the archive wants the negative, so the digital source master doesn't always get it. But the problem then is, I mean, if I get the film, the analog film material, it's the film material. But if I get the file, it can be encrypted, and it can be not encrypted, it can have a code, and code can be encoded. And that means that I have the file, but I cannot use it. It's not like the analog image, I can always see what is there. It can just be a file that is not, that I'm not able to use. And for an archive, of course, this is a huge problem, because a file that I cannot use, I cannot look at it, I cannot restore it, I cannot give access to it for nobody, and so it's no use at all. But I have heard from, for example, German National Archives, that this is an existing problem, that there are film producers who are willing to give their digital copy to the archive, but only encode it, because they are still afraid that somehow somebody could make a copy and put it on the internet, and so the whole piracy thing. So they are even afraid that the archival institutions will not work properly with their files, so they give in cold material, and for the archive this is worthless. So this is are all problems in the digital works, digital world, and so this is an indirect. This is following indirectly from the problems of digitalization, that the whole rights problems. Of course, they existed before the whole copyrights problems, but now, with the digitalization, with the possibility to give access to huge masses of material online and so on and so on, the copyright problem, of course, is much more on the agenda than before. And one huge copyright problem for archives are the orphan works. And orphan works are films with unsolved copyright. And for example, let's say in the 1930s or 40s, there was not a contract that gave, that the contracts, the old contracts at the time, did not say that everybody who was part of this film as a technician or as an actor gave the rights to the producer. Today it's like that, so if I want to clear the copyright for a film, I know I have to find out who has this copyright, is one institution or one person, and I can ask directly for the copyright, and if I get it, I have it. With those old films, it's different because those contracts did not exist. That means if I want to check copyright for an old film, I have to find every single person who is in this film and be it for 2 seconds and ask him or his children or whatever, do I have to write to show this film? Everybody who is part of the film, as actor, as technician, I have to ask everybody. And of course, this is almost impossible. And it's not only impossible, it's very expensive. I need manpower to do this research and so on. And it's funny, but it's an existing, very urgent problem for film archives that is discussed internationally, and it's important to find other solutions. It should be more easier for film archives to clear those copyrights. It means because they have to show later that they made efforts to clear the copyright before they can say it's impossible to do it. And the question is, what kind of efforts do they have to do? Today they really, the idea is that they have to ask everyone and do this research. It's impossible. One had to have to find another solution which makes it easier and less expensive and so on. So this is another thing that is discussed, the orphan works. And then database, of course, with the digitalization, the database becomes ever more important. And the database, for example, in Film Heritage Institution, the database that gives the information about all the film material, the state of the film material, the content of the film material, but also of the other objects of everything that is in the archive. And there are several problems linked to this database idea. One is that traditionally, we have talked about it earlier, traditionally, the archival knowledge is personalized knowledge. The archivist knows. And if you want to know something about the items in the archive, you ask the archivist. He's the person who knows. The question is, okay, what if he dies? Or she. Or what if she doesn't like me, the archivist? Then I didn't get the information or what? And exactly, that's how it works. And so in the archive, there are always several kinds of truths. It depends on whom you ask and on which level you get into the archive, or how important and how much knowledge is the person you ask and how much knowledge does he have, and so on. So the idea of the database, of course, it's to objectivize all this information, to put it in a place where everybody has access to it, or not everybody maybe, but a defined circle of people, not only one. And so the database is the archive of the knowledge of the archivists, if you want to. And I know from German archives that there are really aggressive fights inside the institutions between, let's say, people from the older generation who don't want to give their knowledge, and other people who want to implement databases, and it's a problem. And the other problem of the database is the standardization of the metadata and the international exchange. Yeah, so I give in the database, I give the information about the films that I have. And of course, I don't write novels, yeah, but I give keywords and so on, and they need a standard, and this standard must be international if I want to come to a point where I can compare with other archives. What do you have? What do I have? And so on. And this is the whole idea behind it. And there are now European institutions who have in the last couple of years, in the last years, worked on these standards, and they have formed standards and so on. But this is so work is done, but it's. I mean, you then have to implement these rules in every national archive, which is then the next step, which is maybe even more difficult to do. And there is, of course, also there are huge chances connected to this digitalization and the work with database. And one example. You can check this out. It's a very interesting internet platform. It's called Lost Films. It has been created by the Deutsche Kinemathek, but it's an international platform. And of course, the problem of lost films is the problem that you know that from the first 20 or 30 years of film history, maybe 80% of the films are said to be lost, and even from the last years, there are always films that are gone, that nobody knows where to find them, and so on. And this Lost Films platform has two possibilities. One is, it's mainly for archives. One is, for example, many archives have unidentified material in their archive. They have just clips from films, and they don't know what it is. And they can scan them and put them on this homepage, and they can give all the all the information that they have on this material. Maybe they also have related items, photos. They can put it there with the question, okay, does anybody know to which film this clip here belongs or so? And the other possibility is you can say, okay, in our national cinema, film history, for example, these films are said to be lost, and these are very important films. We would like to find them also. And then all the other archives can check if they have something about it. And I mean, and this works. Many films have been found and identified that way. And that has to do with the fact that before film archives, I mean, there is the FIAF, the International organization of the film archives, but the exchange between film archives has never been very good, very open, because many film archives, I mean, the business of film archiving is mainly based on piracy. It was in the beginning. That means that, you know, one in the early days, in the 50s or 60s or 70s, I don't know, the British Film Archive wanted to screen a film that was in the French Film Archive, so they ordered this film, and FIAF mainly organized this exchange between copies internationally. So, but when they got the film from France, they not only screened it, they also secretly made an illegal copy to store in their own archive. This is how the film archives grew. So film archiving is based on piracy, and this is the reason why no film archive in the world wants to put their catalog on the internet and say, this is all we have. Because then other archives would say, how comes that, and so on. And so, but now with all this database and so on and so on and the digitalization, maybe this changed a little bit. And it's also, it's so many years ago that they stole all these films. Maybe we don't talk about this anymore and just open up our catalogs. So, but this is why something like this Lost Film platform is important, because this exchange between archives, this is something completely new. And it has a lot to do with this digitalization. I want to give you just shortly another, where's the cursor? Idea of importance of digitalization. So this is a presentation of a colleague of mine. I just show you, because I find it so interesting, the idea. I just show you some of his PowerPoint stuff. So the colleague is Jürgen Kuiper. He's the director of the IT department at the Deutsche Kinemathek in Berlin. And he is, for example, the guy who tries to implement databases in the archive and so on. And so once he gave a presentation, and it's interesting because he says in that presentation that one effect of the digitalization is the destruction of the classical archive. If we understand the classical archive as a unit in one building, a unit, an organization where the films are archived and where people who want to study the films have to go to look at the films there. And so you have the storage of the film, also the cataloging and so on, and the reconstructions and are made there, and also the films are screened there for the scholars and so on. So this is the unit of the film archive. And he says, okay, these are different functions of the archive who were always a unit. It's the classical archive, and with digitalization, this will be destructed, this unit. And his example, he takes this example not from the film archive, but he found this archive. It's a quite new archive. It's in Norway, and it's an archive for seeds. All the seeds in the world are collected and stored in this archive, which is it's a cave also. This is only the entrance. It's underground. And global seed vault. Yeah. The interesting thing is, to go through his presentation, he marked the date. It's can you read that? 26th of February 2006 or 2008, I think. And the interesting thing is that at the same day when this archive was opened, inaugurated in Norway, somewhere in the United States, researchers found the sequence genome of corn, so of one of the seeds that is stored in the archive, at exactly the same date they published it in the internet, that they had disclosed this DNA sequence or whatever. And what he tries to say with this is that, of course, the information they had as a basis for their work on the seed was from the archive, and But what I worked on this DNA of the seed was not where the seed is archived. And of course, this has a lot to do with the digital transmission of information. And I mean, it's obvious that with film, this can be the same. If you have every film that is permanently stored somewhere in a digital version that can be accessed, I can access it from everywhere and study it. So I don't need to go to the archive. And also, for example, today, the Deutsche Kinemathek, they have some material that they store that was digitally produced, and they don't store it at their archive, but they store it at the Center for what is the English name for that? Whatever, at the technology park where they have huge digital storage space. And in this storage park, information from, for example, the government is stored beside film material from the film archive. That means that it's a storage space where information from different kind of institutions and so on are stored. And so you have something like still the archive, people who work as archivists, but the material they work with is stored at another place, and there it is stored with different kind of materials. And so it's already happening, the destruction of the classical archive. And in the future, of course, it's very probable that you have a place where all information is stored, and not only the information of one institution, but of different institutions. And then another place, the people sit who are responsible for the material, maybe, and who catalog it and collect the information. Another place are the scholars who study it. They don't have to go to neither one of those places, and so on. So this is the destruction of the classical archive. Oh, this is not where I wanted to go. Tuk tuk. Yeah. Okay. And my last point would be that for people who are interested in film aesthetics, I think the digitalization is a new start, because I mean, when you think about the coming of VHS in the 70s, for example, I think it's not by accident that structuralist studies of film narration were mainly written after the invention of VHS, because of course it's very difficult to watch a film once in a cinema and then write about its structure, because you have to see it not only once, but again and again to study the narrative structure, maybe. And so it's interesting when you start thinking of that, because all those famous film critics and so on of the 1920s or 30s or 40s, you always have to keep in mind when you read their stuff, they have seen this film maybe once and they write out of their memory. They hadn't the possibility to study this film. So then with VHS, it's obvious that then people started to study, for example, the narrative strategy, structure. But for the aesthetics or for the image itself, I think VHS was still, I mean, the quality was very bad mostly. So with digital, you have completely different possibilities. The image is better. You can study the film at home. You can study it frame by frame. Also not really possible with VHS. And there's a completely different take on the film image. And so with the digital revolution, I think aesthetical studies of audiovisuals have grown and will also grow in the future. So these just a few ideas about the digitalization. I leave that out. And let's come just quickly before I show you some examples to the question of archival images, compilation, found footage, and remix. I have sent you this text by William Weiss. There are incredibly few texts on compilation and found footage and so on. And so Weiss from 1992, he's from the Anthology Film Archive in New York, which is the avant-garde film archive. And so this text from the early 90s is one of the key and reference texts. And I just, even if you can agree or disagree with what he says, it's not stupid what he says. So I think you can take that as a first step to think about this kind of filmmaking. And so he gives one typology in this text, which is interesting for starters, is that there are, so if you talk about found footage, there are perfect films, what he calls. This means you find a film in a certain structure and condition and so on, and you just, like a ready-made object, take it and screen it. This is the found footage film. And there are there is, for example, a found footage film who is actually called Perfect Film. And it's a film that the filmmaker found recently somewhere, and it's about the assassination of Martin Luther and some interviews shot directly after the assassination with people on the street. And this, nobody knew that film strip before. It was lying somewhere, I don't know where, and he found it and just took it. He didn't edit it somewhere together. He just took it how he had found it, named it Perfect Film, and showed it. And so this is classic example for perfect film. Then, of course, the other possibility would be to edit the material, the montage. And so the third concept is the modification of the material. That means, you know, you scratch it and you burn it and you paint it and whatever. So this is his first typology. The second typology is threefold, and he starts with a compilation film, and he gives keywords like a reality, documentary film, realism for compilation. What he basically what he wants to say is that I can quote here from compilation films may reinterpret images taken from film and television archives, but generally speaking, they do not challenge the representational nature of the images themselves. That is, they still operate on the assumption that there is a direct correspondence between the images and their profilmic sources in the real world. Yeah, that means compilation films for him are films where people go into the archive, take films out, and edit them in a new way, but they still treat these images as documents of something. They take that for serious. They take that seriously, this documentary aspect. And so a key example is Esther Schupp. She normally in the film history, one says that a compilation film was invented in Russia in the 20s, and one key figure is Esther Schupp. She worked with Kuleshov and Vertov and Eisenstein and so on. And she first job was to re-edit American films for the Russian public, but then she became known for a film from 1927 in which she took material from the Tsarist era, that is documentary material, which should document the glory of the Tsar and so on. And she re-edited the material and put new intertitles in it in order to criticize this glorification of the Tsar. For example, she took images of noble people sweating because they dance at the celebration and intercut it with material from workers and peasants who sweated because they had to work very hard. So this was the political, ideological idea behind it. So for Wies, these are compilation films because, of course, via montage, they criticize and so on, but they take their source material seriously. And so they say that film have a historical value. This is not criticized in a compilation film. And maybe I have to mention Jay Leda. This is the first key study on compilation film. This is from 1964. The book is called Films Beget Films. So film create new films, or films are created out of older films. And it's interesting because this guy, Jay Leda, he coined the term compilation film, but he didn't like this expression. So in the introduction to his book, he tries out many concepts and words. He tries archive film, documentary archive film, montage film, montage chronicle film, stock footage film, library film, found footage film, and so on. And his conclusion is, okay, I don't like the word compilation film, but maybe it's still the best or so. And this word stuck, and people use it until today, compilation film. So this is compilation film, and so his second concept in this typology is the collage, and this for him is the queen concept. This is the king concept. This is the most important concept. And so collage does everything that the compilation does not. It means it criticizes. Yeah, it criticizes not only the ideological content, the image, like the Tsarist view or so, but it criticizes the images as an image. It points into question if the image is a document for something or for what and so on, you know. So this is his keywords for collage are image, avant-garde film, modernism. And here he says, for example, the kinds of representation that compilation films tend to take for granted are precisely the kind college films call into question. So, and then the last concept here is appropriation, connected to simulacrum, music video, and postmodernism for him as keywords. What he wants to say is that for him, these are films that take archival images just for superficial reasons. Yeah, they take these images, but the images are not connected to anything. This is the basic meaning of this word simulacrum. Yeah, it's a sign for nothing. Yeah, nothing is behind it, and so for him this is really stupid. And to give you, he gives concrete examples in his text, and I'm going to show it to you. The first concrete example for compilation is, so the image that he chose is the mushroom of the atomic bomb explosion. Yeah, this is the image it shows, and he says, okay, this can be implemented in films in different ways, and so the compilation would be this one. It's from the film Atomic Cafe.
American officials discussed plans with the Bikini natives for the evacuation of the atoll. The islanders are a nomadic group and are well pleased
that the Yanks are going to add a little variety to their lives.
And here, by the way, you hear them singing their Marshallese version of You Are My Sunshine.
So I think it becomes clear. He says that this is compilation because here these images are embedded in a retelling of this whole atomic craze of how they tried out these bombs in the Pacific. And he also know they show in this film, they show this duck and hide films and so on, when how the Americans were instructed what to do when the Russians throw atomic bombs on us and so on. So it's a retelling of this era of the atomic craze. So this is why it's a compilation for Wies. Then a second example for the collage is taken from maybe the best known found footage film ever. It's called A Movie from Bruce Conner. And unfortunately, I have only a very, very bad version of it because somebody has filmed it from the screen in the cinema. So it's, I didn't find it's not on DVD or so. It's such a famous film and it's so difficult to get it, I think. And so I'll still show you this. I won't show you the whole film because it's a bit too long, but so you can see he works with a very different kind of material. So the leader, for example, comes, then the end comes in the beginning, and then comes again the leader, and so on. It's very typical for him, but I want to... this film is so famous because it's a commentary on, I mean, this is a film from the 1950s, it's a commentary on television, which was a new medium then, and on this flow of images, of popular images and so on in the American culture. And but there is also something with atomic bomb explosion, and I'm going to show it to you. So this is in the middle of the movie, is the title and so on. This is typical for him. Yeah. So that was it, and it was a very famous sequence. I mean, it's obvious. It's if you want to the psychoanalytical study, it's like you know, in the Hitchcock films when the train goes into the tunnel. This is also a symbol for sexual intercourse or whatever. And here it's the torpedo and then the explosion and so. And for Weiss, this is collage because of course the images are not taken as what they are, but are shown in a completely different context. So the atomic explosion is then the ejaculation or whatever, for example. I mean, it's nothing special nowadays, but maybe in the 50s it was really a kind of revolution how to treat images. And so his example for appropriation is a Michael Jackson video. And it's the video for Man in the Mirror from 1987, and there's only a very short passage with the atomic image, but basically I wanted to show that differently. Hello? Ah, whatever. I show it like this. So basically it's Michael Jackson performing, and he embeds into this performance very, very short clips of political or international events. And like, for example, no, here it seems so. Difficult to find. Like here, then the atomic. And then this was the atomic explosion, yeah. And so, and he thinks about change, yeah, we have to change the world or whatever. Who? Stop it. And then, he shows these clips, and they are just used in the superficial meaning, like this is something evil and I'm good and we have to change the world or so. And this is so his example for appropriation, which he detests, Weiss, obviously. I mean, there are, of course, he could have gone on with atomic pictures, of course, because there is also a fiction film like Dr. Strangelove.
We must not allow a mine shaft gap,
sir.
I have a plan. Monsieur has it locked.
And so on. So also in fiction films you can find archival footage, and here I would say in a collage modus if we take Weiss. But I mean, this is interesting to note because there is a difference between a film like Atomic Cafe or even a movie, the two first that I've shown, and the video clip and Dr. Strangelove, because the first two films are films that are entirely made of archival footage, and the others is a music video or a fiction film that include a small part of archival images. That means it's not enough to have this typology of compilation film, collage film, and appropriation film, because you also need a term to designate films that use only in small parts archival images. And then the term maybe is archival image. At least somebody who writes a lot about it has coined it, like that archival images. Yeah. So there are, but this is interesting to keep in mind. Yeah. Yeah.
And what about the films like Kolaniskatsi, Povakatsi, Nakulikatsi, or from Joffrey Regia or Baraka or something like this? Is it found footage, and which category is this?
I'm not sure if this is found footage, because I guess
all of this is not original.
Is that true? I didn't know that.
It's found footage.
Yeah, maybe you can give me the answer. What would you say? What is it?
I'm not sure. Maybe collage. Maybe collage, but I'm not sure with it.
I would say it's compilation, no?
Compilation, collage, or
because
or the last category was appropriation. I'm not sure which category it is.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the point about categories. Once you have them, you can apply them and discuss them. I mean, of course, this is it's no natural law. It's useless to say, okay, this is collage, and it's it because it was born collage, now it is collage, but because this is a term somebody coined, and you can just take these terms and take Kolaniskatsi and use the terms to ask yourself, is it maybe collage or is it appropriation, just to start a discussion about a film, but I don't know. I don't have my world of film is not that I have every film I know I have registered in these categories. I would have to see it now, and then I could talk about it. But now, if I remember the film well, I would say it's a compilation film. But no. One other thing that I wanted to say is that this is also interesting. Bruce Conner, the guy who made this movie film, I mean, he is probably the, until today, the best known found footage filmmaker. By the way, another thing that you could, another quality that you could assign to these terms is, you could say compilation is about history, and collage is about art. And then you see that Kolaniskatsi maybe is not a collage film, yeah.
Yeah,
but then what is appropriation about? And but okay, Bruce Conner is maybe the best known collage or found food. Normally, then yeah. Instead of collage, maybe you can, I think normally people don't say collage, they say found footage when they mean collage. It's very difficult with all those terms, yeah, because as I said, these are not natural laws, it's just the way how you try to talk about those things. And but what I wanted to say is this Bruce Conner, I mean, in this book, in this Weiss book, William Weiss, he has a passage in the end with interviews with filmmakers. And here's an interview with Bruce Conner. And Bruce Conner is, as I said, a key figure in found footage filmmaking. And the whole book by William Weiss is dedicated to Bruce Conner. So it's his, really his god. Yeah. And it's so interesting when you read this interview with Bruce Conner, because he contradicts Weiss totally. So his own god contradicts him totally, because, I can read it to you, Bruce Conner... the first thing that he says, I find it also very interesting. He says, my approach to filmmaking, whether I have shot the film or taken footage from another film, is not different. All footage is found footage for a film editor. I think this is also interesting to keep in mind. He says, okay, it's no use to take a category as found footage, because if you are in the editing room, it's all found footage. Because normally you haven't shot the film when you edit it. So for a film editor, everything is found footage. But then, and this is what I want to say, he says, I disagree with the tendency to make found footage a category rather than a description. And possibly montage comes closer than collage, because collage, as I understand it, is a French word that deals with the placing of separate layers of paper on a flat surface. Assemblage is a French word, but it's also an English word. But it's such an all-inclusive term that it has virtually no definition whatsoever. I don't think we should be talking about collage when we speak of film, we should be talking about montage. It's interesting. So Weiss invents this category of collage exactly for Bruce Conner's film, A Movie. And Bruce Conner, in this interview with Weiss, says, but I don't think we should call it collage, because collage is something made in layers. And here we are talking about sequences. Okay. If we take Conner seriously, and he says that, okay, maybe we shouldn't make collage or found footage or so as a category, then we can think of a third typology, which is what I want to propose. So if we talk about all this compilation and found footage and whatsoever films, archival films, then maybe we should not so much concentrate on is it a collage or appropriation or what is it, but concentrate, for example, on the implemented artistic strategies. For example, the loop, which is a strategy for found footage film, or the slow motion via multiplication of frames, yeah, or freeze frames or so, the wrong speed, yeah, playing with the speed, zooming in the images, alteration of dialogue and music and so on. Yeah, those strategies are interesting to study, maybe more interesting than is it a collage or whatever. Also the motifs, yeah, for example, as you have seen, Bruce Conner often used leaders films, or those The End or whatever, some motifs, or as I've already mentioned, the decaying nitrate as an image is, for example, a motif in found footage film, and so on. Interesting are maybe also the political and artistic contexts in which those films were made. Yeah, sometimes those films are accompanied by manifests or programs or something like that. For example, there was a movement of the Situationists, the 50s, and one key figure was Guy Debord, a French guy. And already in the mid-1950s, he wrote a user's guide to Détournement. And this was in the 1950s, and Détournement became an important strategy in the 1970s then as an ideological fighting strategy of the communists, or the situationists were mostly communists, or of the left. And détournement means, okay, taking a film and completely changing its meaning by, for example, subtitling it. They took mostly, for example, Japanese B-movies and subtitled it with political image messages. Or you can also dub it, of course. And so this is a strategy, and it's also an artistic strategy, but it's also a strategy that is has been invented inside a political movement, for example. This is interesting to study. And by the way, if you take today, I mean, there's also the word of remix, which is always linked to the to digital objects, so to the kind of found footage filmmaking in the internet, on YouTube, and so on. And détournement is a key strategy. For example, the German film Der Untergang, what is the international title, about the last days of Hitler. What is the international? I don't remember the international title, but it's about the last days of Hitler in the Führerbunker and so on. And for example, there are 5 million sequences of the film subtitled in English with completely nonsense, because of course most Americans don't understand the German original, so if they put English subtitles to tell another story, they can't compare it with the German sound. And so this is for example very important for American YouTube culture, and there are many other examples. So Détournement is And this is, by the way, another thing with the internet culture. There are there's almost not one single good text about the whole internet culture of remixing. The texts written by someone who knows about the tradition of all these strategies, because, as in the case of this détournement, all the strategies of mashing up and remixing and recutting used in the internet, they of course have a history in analog filmmaking, and they have traditions, and all the motifs and strategies that are used have been used in other contexts before. And the problem that I see at the moment is that people who are into found footage and compilation in the analog world, they are not very much into the remix culture, and people who are interested in the remix culture, they mostly don't know about these traditions of film history. So there are virtually no texts, no good texts that take into account both the new remix culture and the tradition behind it. This is something for future PhDs or film scholars or whatever to do. So, is the time over, or do we have?
We have 15 minutes.
Okay, then I will use this 15 minutes to show other examples of found footage film history, just to give you a few key examples. I don't think we have the time to show everything, but maybe, for example, it's interesting to have a look at this film, because this is, if you want, the first, not compilation, but the first found footage, or the first collage film, then, or is said to be the first. It's from 1936. It's called Rose Hobart, and by Joseph Cornell. And Joseph Cornell was an artist. So he was known for his carefully crafted glass-fronted boxes containing enigmatic arrangements of found object and images. So he came from a completely different context, and then he started to make some found footage films, and this is his first and his most famous. And the film is called Rose Hobart because what he did is he took sequences of American feature film called East of Borneo, and he only took the sequences with the main female actress, whose name is Rose Hobart in the film. This is why his film is called Rose Hobart, and it only shows sequences, but not in the chronology, only sequences with the main character. And what he also did is, this is a sound film, this East of Borneo, the film that he took, but he showed it without the original sound and in silent speed, and he put some Brazilian samba music on it, and he also, it's a black and white movie, showed it through a blue filter. So there are already in this first found footage film some artistic strategies, like putting color, putting another sound, changing the speed and so on, which were then applied again and again. And it's interesting that this film was first screened in a gallery in New York, and present was Salvatore Dali, who was very, very angry afterwards because he said that this guy had stolen his own idea. He also wanted to make something like this. And I'll just show you a few seconds of your idea.
Dança pega como aquele eu nunca vi. Curru paco papá, curru 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 paco. Assim sempre dizia o papagaio da Lili. Curru paco papá, curru 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 paco. Papagaio dança pega como aquele eu nunca vi. Que papagaio inteligente.
I just show you this few seconds. It's 30 minutes or so long, and it's difficult to make out a sense of this film. You have to watch it, I think, several times until you get a little bit what it's about. But I wanted you to see at least aesthetically how it's done. And maybe use the time to show you some other examples. I find this one very interesting because it seems that it was kind of the invention or one of the first applications of the loop, which became one of the key strategies for video art, for example, but also for found footage filmmaking. And so many films here. Shit, what did I call it? I don't know how I called it. Pardon me. I hope I find it. Ah. So it's from 1965. It's a German film. And it's interesting because it starts with a message, and it's in German, so I translate to it in English. It says, "I modify material by repeating it unmodified. The message is the behavior of the material towards the frequency of its repetition." So, in fact, it's also a kind of perfect film because he doesn't work with the material. The only thing that he does is he repeats it over and over, and he says that through repetition, there is a new, the images get new meaning or whatever. Yeah? And this. Becomes almost religious, I think, like a mantra. It's monotonous, and it's a meditation. Okay, so just maybe because I've talked about it so much, about the motive of the decaying nitrate material, and just there's a whole film called Decaysia. It's quite new. It's from 2002. It's 10 years old, by Bill Morrison. And the whole film is about this phenomenon. I'll just give you an idea about it. And as I said, slow motion here, also very typical strategy for treating archival material. So he starts with the laboratories and so on. So the whole film is about the beauty of decay, if you want to. Just one, this is interesting because there is another, let's say, I mean, if you want to say it's another term, you should be careful with if you call them genres of found footage or something. There is one that you could call, I don't know, the paradigmatic genre also, and it's very typical in the remix culture. For example, if you see films on the internet that just collect shots taken from God's Eye View in fiction films also, yeah? And it's just a collection of similar shots somehow from the same perspective or so. And so this kind of sortation and of paradigmatically collecting and exposing material from different movies, this is a structuralist strategy. This is also a typical item of found footage, and especially the remix culture. And this is a famous example of a German experimental filmmaker, Matthias Müller. It's called Home Stories. And it's it's at the same time he collects material from American Hollywood movies with famous leading ladies, and it's kind of an analysis of the structure of these films, because he finds that in almost every of these Melos there are the same shots, yeah, a woman lying in the bed, trying opening the door, blah, blah, blah. And so he puts them, those images from the different films after another. I just give it a... By the way, this is a film that I have on DVD. The quality is so bad because the guy worked with VHS. Because this is another thing, when you make a found footage film, I mean, you normally can take the negative and work on it also. And even it's difficult to work on the positive copy. Yeah? So this is an older film. There was no digitalization. So he worked with VHS material, and you can see it. Huh? Thank you. So you got an idea about it. And so to kick you out, one last thing. just a second. Where do I have it? Okay. I will comment it later.
Made in Japan. I'm sitting here chatting with Woody Allen, the author of this film. Woody, is the word author quite the correct word to use? I mean, what exactly did you do with that film?
Well, let me see if I can explain this to you accurately. They wanted in Hollywood to make the definitive spy picture.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to me to supervise the project, you know, because I think that if you know me at all, you know that death is my bread and danger my butter. Oh, no, danger is my bread and death is my butter. Danger is my bread. Death is my, death and danger are my various breads and various butters. So we took a Japanese film made in Japan by Japanese actors and actresses. We bought it. And it's a great film, beautiful color, and there's raping and looting and killing in it. And I took out all the sound, knocked out all their voices, and I wrote a comedy. And I got together with some actors and actresses, and we put our comedy in where they were formerly raping and looting. And the result is a movie where people are running around, killing one another, and, you know, doing all those James Bondian things, but what's coming out of their mouth is something wholly other.
I see. That's, to my recollection, I've never heard of that being done before, where the actors would be acting one story and saying another.
It was, actually. It was done in Gone with the Wind. Not many people know that. Those are Japanese people, actually, and he dubbed in American voices on it, with Southern voices.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. It was years ago, though, during the war, and there have been many naval bases and things, so, you know, kept quiet.
Yeah, well, be that as it may, do you think we could run this film now?
Sure. Watch this.
So, I have to tell you that unfortunately the film is not very funny, apart from this introduction. But what I just wanted to say is that I have told you about this manifesto for Détournement from 1956. And it's funny that Woody Allen was the first to do it in practice, and I think without knowing about this Détournement manifest. This is from 1965, and the French who had wrote this manifesto, they did their first film in that style in 1973, much later, and not by dubbing but with subtitling. But they also took Japanese B-movies just like him. It's interesting. Okay, thank you very much for your attention. See you tomorrow.